field of endeavor. A lot of it does not intrinsically make sense to human beings that have evolved to the macro world that we have. But it's sort of interesting occasionally. You can take quantum mechanical concepts that are not intuitive, and you can simplify the cases to approximate real-life situations and watch as the weirdness kind of drops out. And what you're left with is fundamentally quite Newtonian physics. One of those YouTubes that I have linked, it does that with reflection and refraction. So it's always nice when that happens. It doesn't happen all the time. There's a lot of math involved in physics, unfortunately. People don't really care. Well, mathematicians love it, but non-mathematicians don't. So it's a fascinating subject. So when you have nothing better to do, go to roy.ac2gs and click on those links and watch some YouTube. You'll learn something.
Very good. I'll do that. KD2NVV. Back to that.
Welcome, Bob. Any other comments, questions, or answers before I move on to some of my little stories here? Okay, we've talked about a planned 2024 NASA mission for a manned or sometimes a womanned lunar landing. Unfortunately, the people over in the Congress that haven't been talking much about it, though. At a House hearing held November 13th in Washington, D.C., members of Congress and space experts voiced serious concerns about NASA's current plan to send American men and women to the moon in just 5 years. On March 26, 2019, Vice President Mike Pence told NASA it had 5 years to put Americans back on the moon, which was 4 years ahead of the previous scheduled return date of 2028. This directive represented a small step for the Trump administration, but it's very possibly a giant leap too far for NASA, according to comments made this past Wednesday at a congressional subcommittee hearing held in Washington, D.C. This is a critical time for NASA's Artemis program as Congress mulls over its 2021 budget to be released early next year. The space agency is currently scrambling to appease this presidential order, with NASA hinting it would need an additional $25 billion over the next 5 years to accelerate the timeline, which represents an additional $4 billion to $5 billion annually. That said, NASA has yet to provide the House Appropriations Committee with a full cost estimate, which, much to its frustration. The hearing held Wednesday was titled Keeping Our Sights on Mars Part 2, Structuring a Moon-Mars Program for Success, and it was organized by the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology Subcommittee on Space and Aeronautics. In her opening remarks, Subcommittee Chair Kendra Horn said the critical questions before us now are what decisions and actions are needed to structure a Moon and Mars program for sustainability and success, adding that it is imperative that we take this opportunity to hear from our witnesses on what it takes to create a sustainable and effective pathway towards sending humans to the Moon and Mars. Let me drop for a sec. Those witnesses were former NASA astronaut Thomas P. Stafford, who participated in the Gemini and Apollo programs, and A. Thomas Young, the former director of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. An arbitrary deadline that is uninformed by technical and programmatic realities, that is unaccompanied by a credible plan, and that fails to identify the needed resources, is one that sets NASA up to fail rather than enabling it to succeed, he said. Chairwoman Etty Bernice Johnson did not mince words during her opening remarks, expressing serious doubts about NASA's current plan, while Johnson said she supports a robust program to eventually send Americans to Mars. It has to be sustainable. She went on to say, unfortunately, based on the limited information provided to date, the administration's 2024 lunar landing directive appears to be neither executable nor a directive that will provide a sustainable path to Mars. Proponents of the administration's crash program may argue that such a deadline will still will instill a sense of urgency and motivation into our space program. However, an arbitrary deadline that is uninformed by technical and programmatic realities, that is unaccompanied by a credible plan, and that fails to identify the needed resources, is one that sets NASA up to fail rather than enabling it to succeed. Not only does that do the hard-working men and women of NASA and its contractor teams a real disservice, but it will wind up weakening American leadership in space rather than strengthening it, she said. NASA Chief Jim Bridenstine appears reticent to admit that NASA is incapable of meeting the 2024 deadline or the technological innovations demanded by the Artemis mission, saying that the space agency can most certainly accomplish this task, but only if fully funded. The ball, as far as Bridenstine is concerned, is fully in Congress's court. Let me drop for a sec. During the hearing, both Stafford and Young expressed similar concerns with the current Artemis plan. Quotes, the mission I did, Apollo 10, accomplished the whole thing with one launch, said Stafford, as reported in Space News. Citing comments made elsewhere by former NASA official Doug Cook, Stafford said that the probability of success, as Cook outlined, and I cannot disagree with it, was only 50%, he told the House subcommittee. I would certainly not want to start that. In reference to NASA's still uncompleted Jumbo rocket, the Space Launch System, Stafford said, if you don't have it, you're not going to make it. Young said NASA should entertain more conventional approaches in terms of how Artemis should be managed, such as fewer experiments with contractors, whether it be to develop crew capsules or lunar landers. These endeavors should be government-acquired assets under the leadership and direction of NASA, said Young, as reported in Space News. Young added that NASA is overwhelmed right now with Artemis and other missions, that a smart intermediate next step would be to delay the proposed $504 million Lunar Gateway project. They plan to construct a relay station in orbit around the moon. The Lunar Gateway makes sense for a mission to Mars, but for the moon, not so much, he said. Let me drop for a sec. This isn't the first time a House committee has articulated these sorts of concerns. Back on October 16th, the House Appropriations Committee conducted a hearing about NASA's moon landing proposal. Here's what Congressman Jose E. Serrano, the chair of the Commerce, Justice, Science, and Related Agencies Appropriations Subcommittee, had to say during that particular hearing. At a time of huge financial needs across numerous government programs, all competing for funding within the budget caps, an additional $25 billion cost would severely impact vital programs not under this subcommittee, but across all non-defense subcommittees. We cannot sacrifice quality just to be quick. We cannot sacrifice safety to be fast. And we cannot sacrifice other government programs just to please the president. So it would seem that support from Congress appears to be waning, both for practical and political reasons. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Yes, Craig, you're sounding a little bit noisy. Maybe point the antenna a little bit closer.
My basement, that's why. I've been following up with this, with about colonizing Mars. The problem, though, is moving to Mars wouldn't be simple, and even if an advanced society colonized Mars, this new home would be temporarily. And on top of that, not many people realize, but the move to Mars actually, for now, is actually considered one way. Once you go there, there's no way of getting back.
Well, Craig, you know, I mean, on the TechNet, both the regular TechNet, the Science Talk, and Paul's Space Report, we've kind of gone over the numerous engineering problems with the whole concept of taking human beings, putting them in a tin can, and sending them to the next closest planet. There's a lot of problems. There's problems dealing with microgravity or zero gravity. There's problems with radiation exposure. And then there's problems of what do you do even if you're able to land. You'll be as kind of weak as kittens. And it's a very hostile environment. you have to be able to kind of jump up as soon as you land, and I don't know how the hell they're going to do that either. There's all kinds of problems. How do you get enough energy to run things? Where do you find raw materials to process them into useful form? It's an engineering nightmare, and maybe someday we'll surmount it, but I tend to believe that future missions that at least I'm going to be watching are going to be robotic in nature, that they're not going to have human beings, but they're going to have machines that are able to do relatively concise, repeatable processes. But who knows? I understand the wanderlust of wanting to put a man on Mars. I just don't think we're technologically capable of doing it in a reasonable manner.
That's why I said it wouldn't be very simple. You'd be missing a lot of key components. And this would be a temporary home. As the sun gets bigger, then you got to move farther out again. But I've been watching videos about this quite often, and there's even been a talk of actually attempting to move the entire planet, which may seem like fiction, but technology is already being considered to actually test the feasibility of actually moving Earth itself.
Okay, I'm utterly confused by that, because there's really no benefit that I can think of to moving our orbit, not that we have the ability to, not that we're going to have the ability anytime soon to. I guess theoretically, if we change its orbit to be farther from the sun, the temperature will drop and global warming will lessen, I guess. But I wouldn't bet on that one. And probably you'd wreak a lot of havoc with the planet attempting to do something like that. I don't think it would go calmly into that good night.
I watched a video on this, and they say that scientists are running computer simulations to test this possibility of moving Earth using manned or drone rockets every so thousand years to keep pace with the sun.
You have to keep in mind that computer models are just a bunch of bits that are toggled 1 and 0 and 0 and 1. I have computer simulations for planetary systems where I could pick up the moon and smash the Earth with it and see it fly into a billion parts. That doesn't mean that I have the ability to actually do that, and I wouldn't want it. So you might be able to simulate in models doing all kinds of intriguing things, but engineering-wise, lots of luck. We don't have a clue how to do that in a safe and effective way. And I think we're really far away from that.
So it would take a very long time before I guess we would consider something like that. But it's something I thought of, since that's what I was watching in a video recently. I watch science and astronomy all the time, and it just interests me, so that's the reason why I figured I'd bring it up. KD2OGB.
No problem, Craig. That's what this science talk is about, to kind of interact and share opinions and information and ideas. I think that we're in deep trouble if our only option of dealing with global warming is to move our planet. There's got to be something a wee bit more simpler out there. But, again, very nice to play with models. I really like those sandbox programs that lets you maneuver astral bodies all over the place. You can simulate the planets being born out of a field of asteroids. It's a hoot. But it's just a model. It's not definitively what will happen. It's just the best model available at this time. And the engineering feat of doing this in the real world is unrelated to the simple task of getting a computer to simulate that.
Simulation is one thing, but real world is completely different. There would be a lot of different things you'd also have to calculate besides what a computer can think of. So that's why this stuff is just not possible yet.
In my humble opinion, we're really far away from having it work. I mean, It's almost as blue sky as, I don't know if you're familiar with something called a Dyson sphere. A Dyson sphere was a concept that the physicist Dyson came up with of a particularly really advanced civilization who wanted to maximize the amount of habitable land in their particular solar system, would basically build a shell approximately one astronomical unit from the sun, and just it would be like kind of peeling the Earth into a thin layer and just filling it in three dimensions all around the sun. Fascinating. People have written science fiction books on it. There was a very particularly enjoyable Star Trek episode based on a Dyson sphere. Sometimes our engineering imagination is a heck of a lot better than our practical engineering knowledge. So I think in both of those cases, that's what's going on now. But, you know, who knows? Anything subject to change. Who knows if someone's working on something in the lab tonight and is going to revolutionize propulsion and such.
Comment.
There you go.
That's all I've got for now. Carry on, KD2OGB.
Okay, Craig. Someone called out comment.
Yeah, this is John, KC2SHO. You know, the thing that comes to my mind in this discussion is, in many cases, the simulation that the engineers use that I've seen, the resulting product ends up being a little different. You know, the best simulators get you really close, but you end up making tweaks and changes in the end. And I also thought of weather simulations. They use weather simulations all the time, but, you know, they don't always come up with the right answer. AC2GS, KC2SHO.
Yes, I agree, John. Simulations are simplified models. They do not include the incredible complexity of every individual aspect of a system. They try and do the best they can with the computational power and storage capabilities of their computers. You know, some of them are stuck with regular computers, others have access to enormous supercomputers, and you use what you got. Even though you use the best supercomputer, the models are only approximations of reality. And sometimes you can get away with approximations, but if you're moving a planet, you have to know exactly what you're doing once you start doing things like that. Other questions or comments before I move on to the next story? Okay, I hope no one minds if I revisit a few subjects that I've spoken about in the past. The Japanese Space Agency has declared an end to the exploratory phase of the Hayabusa 2 mission. The overachieving spacecraft has left Ryugu and is heading back to Earth, bringing, hopefully, its asteroid samples along with it. After a year and a half of exploratory work around the Ryugu asteroid, the time has finally come for JAXA's Hayabusa 2 spacecraft to return home. At 10:05 a.m. Japanese time on November 13th, the probe received its instructions to leave the Ryugu system. Hayabusa 2 should break free of the asteroid's gravity on November 18th, after which time it will fire its main thrusters and begin its journey towards Earth. The probe is expected to return in December of 2020. Along for the ride will be the all-important asteroid samples. The probe managed to touch the surface twice, attempting to collect surface samples on February 21, 2019, and deeper materials on July 11, 2019. In addition, Hayabusa 2 took numerous photos of the asteroid and deployed several robotic probes to the surface, among other tasks. Looking back, the mission has been nothing short of a spectacular success, though. The final sigh of relief will come when scientists open the cargo containers and confirm that they really do contain the samples of asteroids they were designed to collect. Let me drop for a sec. Thankfully, the year-long journey home is much shorter than the 3.5 years it took for Hayabusa 2 to reach the asteroid. Earth and Ryugu are now closer together along their respective orbital paths compared to 2014, when the asteroid was nearly 186 million miles from Earth. Hayabusa 2 began packing for home early this summer when it placed the sample chamber inside its re-entry capsule. Unlike its predecessor, the Hayabusa 2 spacecraft will not burn up in Earth's atmosphere. Instead, it will jettison the samples once at Earth, where they're expected to land in the South Australian desert. JAXA is currently negotiating with the Aussie government to iron out some important details, including permits to retrieve the re-entry capsule in the restricted Woomera territories. As for Hayabusa 2, it will stay in space, where it could be recycled for another asteroid mission. JAXA scientists are expecting the samples to contain bits of carbon and organic compounds. By studying these samples, scientists hope to glean a new insight into the composition of asteroids and how they formed some 4 billion years ago during the early days of our solar system. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Roy, real quick, W2TTT.
Someone wanted to say something real quick.
Yeah, Roy, did you ever announce the most expensive item that we could buy, or did I somehow miss that?
I guess you missed it. It's anti-protons produced by the CERN's Hadron Collider. They go for about 2.7 quadrillion dollars a gram.
Anti-protons. Okay. I did miss that in the haze of the of poor coverage here in Bergen County. Thank you so much. This has been fascinating to listen to. W2TTT.
Thank you, Gordon. You're always welcome here. We try and put on a good show every Sunday night.
And you succeed. I just wish I could get in better from them. We gotta add a repeater and W2TTT.
I mean, there's always Echolink.
Yeah, it's just not the same when you're driving around listening to that. It's noisy in its own right. W2TTT.
Hey, Gordon. Once again, you're always welcome here. Anyone with any questions or comments before I move on to the next topic?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm glad Hayabusa 2 worked out, because Hayabusa 1 didn't work out that good. They had all kinds of problems with the equipment that was supposed to bring back some kind of sampling, and it really didn't work out. I think they got like a thimbleful of dust or something. But this one seems to be very successful. All I have to do is hope that it lands properly in Australia.
Yeah, it sounds like it was blessed. Everything seems to go right. Of course, that doesn't mean that it's impossible for the satchel to be dropped and land in Australia, and they open it up, and it's basically maybe some fine dust. No one knows for sure what the samples look like and how much mass they have, but we'll hope for the best, and no doubt in 2020, in December, I'll do a story of what they recovered from it.
Yeah, very good. And even if the sample breaks open or something, we had two similar types of missions. They came back from comets. One was the Stardust mission, and the other one was the Genesis mission. Stardust came back intact, you know, on a parachute and all, landed in Utah. But Genesis came down, parachute didn't open up, and things smashed into the earth like, you know, hundreds of miles an hour, and kind of cracked open. But, you know, over time, the scientists were able to get the stuff out of that. And, I mean, slowed them down a lot, you know, but they were able to get a lot of science out of that Genesis mission. So I just hope the thing gets back. You know, the scientists, I mean, that's what it's all about. I mean, the engineering and getting things there and all of that is, you know, that's my favorite part. But the main goal is to make these scientists happy. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. And it's fascinating to me. The one particular concept that strikes me as unique, at least in my imagining, is that they consider that they might still use Hayabusa 2 for another an asteroid run. I'm a little confused of how they intend to do that, unless it has a lot of extra fuel on hand, or they actually intend to refuel it in space. So I'm looking forward to see where that goes to.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it has... let me drop it a second. It has four ion engines on it, and just to get away from the asteroid, they're going to use three. So they use mostly three at any time. The fourth one is a backup in case one fails. So that's how... they have a xenon gas, and they have plenty of fuel to get to somewhere else. You know, they turn those things on, and they could leave those ion engines on for years, you know, not shut them off. It eventually just keeps gaining acceleration and getting to where it's going. But that's how they do it. And then they would, you know, reverse it, you know, reverse the orientation. And again, you fire the ion engines for, you know, maybe 6 months or something to slow it down enough maybe they want to go into orbit around another asteroid. I don't know. I haven't heard the predictions of where this thing is supposed to go to, but maybe they want to do something like that. And they do have the fuel to do it.
Okay, very good. I always like to learn the clever tricks engineers have figured out to show us how amazing things are. And, you know, Hayabusa 2 has generated a lot of press, and this is probably my fifth story on this little Japanese probe. So it's nice to see something work so beautifully. To the next. Do you remember that story about that weird-shaped hyperbody object? At first they called it MU-69, then they renamed it with a much more flashy name. It sounded like it came from some Marvel comic book, Ultima Thule. Well, we live in rather polarized times, so that name had to go. It's back in the news, and it's gotten a bit of a makeover. You may know this rock as the oddly shaped object in the distant Kuiper Belt. We first got a good look at it earlier this year. It was the target of the New Horizons mission after its flyby of Pluto, first discovered in Hubble's Space Telescope data in 2014 by astronomer Mark Bowie. The New Horizons spacecraft passed the rock on New Year's Day of this year to much fanfare. The first data release revealed lots of very interesting tidbits about this rock. It's a bilobed contact binary, meaning it's made of two objects that fuse together. It's surprisingly flat with little dust. It's exciting because it's pristine, a piece of material that seems to be mostly unaltered since the beginning of the solar system itself. But the names for this awesome object haven't been so great. Its initial name was 486958, MU-69, or MU-69 for short. Nominators suggested Ultima Thule during a NASA nickname selecting contest. One of 37 suggestions, and the team went with it due to the term's initial association with a far, icy land in 2018. Though science journalist Megan Bartels wrote about the name's more unsavory connections. Apparently, far-right German mythology uses the term to refer to origins of the Aryan race, and it began to be associated with Nazism and later neo-Nazism. Let me drop for a sec. When question, the New Horizons team mostly doubled down, reiterating that the term had multiple connotations and that it was a wonderful name for exploration. Ultima Thule was just a temporary name, thankfully. Last week, the team announced that the official name of the rock would now be Arrakis. I don't know where they find these things. The New Horizons team selected the name with the consent from the Powhatan tribal elders and representatives and proposed it to the International Astronomical Union and Minor Planet Center, according to a NASA release. The name Arrakis reflects the inspiration of looking to the skies and wondering about the stars and worlds beyond our own, Alan Stern, New Horizons principal investigator, said in the NASA release. That desire to learn is at the heart of the New Horizons mission, and we're honored to join with the Powhatan community and people of Maryland in this celebration of discovery. Both the Hubble Space Telescope and the New Horizons missions are headquartered in Maryland, and the Chesapeake Bay area is an important one for the Powhatan people. Anyway, bye-bye, Ultima Thule, hello, Arrakis. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
It looks like another tough name to learn, but if Alan Stern wants it, I'll go along with him. He's the principal investigator. This guy was terrific throughout that New Horizon mission. He pushed that mission, and he's really one heck of a leader for the year. But a New Horizon team. So, he wanted to be an astronaut when he was younger, but he wound up doing this. I guess they take so many guys, and that's it. But he wound up, in planetary science. Back to you, Roy.
Indeed, they're all doing a great job, and if they want to call it Arrakis, so be it. As I mentioned before, Ultima Thule sort of sounded like it came out of a Marvel comic to me, personally, but what's in a name?
Yeah, but they had a good idea. One part of it was Ultima, the other one was Thule. It looked like a snowman. Two bodies, one main body and one upper body. One big ball, one little ball.
Yes, indeed. It was an odd-shaped rock. We've had a lot of odd-shaped rocks. The next story is about another odd-shaped rock that we've mentioned before.
Okay, let's hear it.
Which is my command. 2 years after the object receded from sight, researchers are still puzzling over Oumuamua's inexplicable behavior. Too agile to be a rocky asteroid, too dry to be an icy comet. The interloper didn't fit in either of the usual boxes. The reason, an emerging but controversial theory contends, is that Oumuamua could have had a porous consistency that made it so light even sunbeams could push it around. Now a new analysis concludes that such a fluffy structure might actually be plausible. While fragile, it might have had the strength to survive its journey without breaking apart. By the time astronomers noticed the Oumuamua in the fall of 2017, it was already speeding back out towards the stars. Astronomers pegged it as an odd cigar-shaped asteroid until they noticed that it was retreating faster than it should have due to gravity alone, behavior unheard of among space rocks, which typically have no other way of gaining speed. In our solar system, the objects that speed up thanks to something other than gravity are usually comets, dirty snowballs that soften when they swing in close to the sun and get propulsive boosts by spraying a shower of melting ice behind them. Yet Oumuamua showed no signs of such cometary tail, even in a recent retroactive analysis of observations from when it should have been melting the most. But if icy plumes weren't driving Oumuamua's speedy escape, what was it? One provocative paper suggested that pressure from the sunlight itself was pushing the object away, as light particles have billiard ball-like momentums that we talked about earlier. But considering Oumuamua's assumed heft as an asteroid, it would need a giant flat surface to catch enough of the sun's rays to get any kind of a boost from the barrage of light particles. Some astrophysicists seeking attention even suggested that aliens were the cause. Let me drop for a sec. In February, however, Space Telescope Science Institute astronomer Amaya Morrow-Martin proposed that the sun was pushing Oumuamua not because it was flying a massive sail, but because Oumuamua was a lightweight. Neither ice nor rock, the object could be a fluffy conglomeration of dust and ice grains. The researchers refer to this structure as a fractal aggregate for its porous patterns that repeat across different size scales. Whether viewed by the naked eye, with a magnifying glass, or under a microscope, a fractal Oumuamua would feature holes of many sizes. Intrigued by Morrow-Martin's suggestion, researchers set out to check whether the fractal aggregate hypothesis held up. They noticed that an observed slowing of Oumuamua's rotation supported the theory, because the speed of the slowing fit with a phenomenon where light can push harder on some parts of a surface, such as the shiny parts, than it pushes on others. When the object cools after being heated up by the sun, the departure of heat exerts gentle pushes as well. All these uneven nudges can add up and make a lumpy object spin faster and slower over time. So, if sunbeams could turn Oumuamua, the researchers reasoned, perhaps they could also speed it up as well. The group also calculated how well the theoretical dust ball would hold together under stress of spinning, and the sun's tendency to gravitationally tug harder on Oumuamua's closer side than its farther side. Let me drop for a sec. Yet the object's extreme properties strained the credulity of other researchers. To visibly respond to sunlight over just months of observation, Oumuamua would need to be 100 times less dense than air at sea level, making it even lighter than the lightest material engineers can presently produce, a substance known as aerogels. These aerogels we create through very careful technology, says Roman Rufikov, an astrophysicist of the University of Cambridge. How do you reconstruct this in interstellar space, he asks. Models of the early solar system have particles bumping into each other and forming small fractal patterns naturally. But Rafikov's question whether these cosmic dust bunnies could really avoid disruption long enough to grow into a Oumuamua-like object, he admits, however, that he prefers the fractal theory to the aliens one, and that he can't come up with a more likely scenario at this point. He says, if I had an alternative, I would have published it long ago. If dust fractals do get big and occasionally stray close enough to the Earth for astronomers to spot them, these observations could tell researchers about the conditions and processes that lead to the formation of planets. But Oumuamua itself has long since disappeared into the night, so astronomers can't evaluate the dust cloud theory through direct observations. And while a second interstellar visitor is passing through the solar system at this very moment, it looks like a typical no-drama comet. Future passers-by, researchers hope, will be members of that oddball Oumuamua family, whatever that family might be. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay. By watching how atoms behave when they're suspended in midair rather than in freefall, physicists have come up with a new way to measure Earth's gravity. Traditionally, scientists have measured gravity's influence on atoms by tracking how fast atoms tumble down tall chutes. Such experiments can help test Einstein's theory of gravity and precisely measure fundamental constants. But the meter-long tube used in freefall experiments can be somewhat unwieldy, difficult to shield from environmental interference, such as stray magnetic fields. With a new tabletop setup, physicists can now gauge the strength of Earth's gravity by monitoring atoms suspended a couple of millimeters in the air by laser light alone. This design, described in the November 8th Science, could better probe the gravitational forces exerted by small objects. The technique also could be used to measure slight gravitational variations at different places in the world, which may help in mapping the seafloor or finding oil and mineral underground deposits. Physicist Victoria Zhu and colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley began by launching a cloud of cesium atoms into the air and using flashes of light to split each atom into a superposition state. In this weird quantum limbo, each atom exists in two places at once. One version of the atom is hovering a few micrometers higher than the other. Zeus' team then traps these split cesium atoms in midair with light from a laser. Measuring the strength of gravity with atoms that are held in place rather than being tugged downward by gravitational fields requires tapping into the atom's wave-particle duality. That quantum effect means that much as light waves can act like particles called photons, atoms can act like waves. And for each cesium atom caught in superposition, the higher version of the atom wave undulates a little faster than its lower counterpart due to the atom's slightly different position in the Earth's gravitational field. By tracking how fast that waviness of the two versions of the atom get out of sync, physicists can calculate the strength of Earth's gravity at that spot. Let me drop for a second. More compact equipment can also measure shorter-range gravity effects, says the study co-author Holger Müller. Let's say you don't want to measure the gravity of the entire Earth, but you want to measure the gravity of a small thing like a marble, he says. We just need to put the marble close to our atoms and hold them there. In a traditional free-fall setup, the atoms would spend a very short time close to our marble, milliseconds, microseconds, and we wouldn't get much in the way of signals. Physicist Kay Bongs of the University of Birmingham in England imagines using this new kind of atomic gravitometer to investigate the nature of dark matter or test a fundamental facet of Einstein's theory of gravity called the equivalence principle. Many unified theories of physics propose to reconcile quantum mechanics and Einstein's theory of gravity, which are both incompatible and violate the equivalence principle in some way. So looking for violations might guide us to a grand unified theory, he said, and that's one of the holy grails in physics. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is KC2GS. Okay, on to the next. In a paper published Friday, November 8th, in the Astrophysical Journal, a Clemson scientist, Marco Agello, and others, collaborated with six other scientists around the world to devise a new measurement of the Hubble constant, the unit of measure used to describe the rate of expansion of our universe. Quote, cosmology is about the understanding the evolution of our universe, how it evolved in the past, and what it's doing now and will happen in the future, said Agello, an associate professor in the College of Sciences Department of Physics and Astronomy. Quote, our knowledge rests on a number of parameters, including the Hubble constant, that we strive to measure as precisely as possible. In this paper, our team analyzed data obtained from both orbiting and ground-based telescopes to come up with one of the newest measurements yet of how quickly the universe is expanding. The concept of an expanding universe was advanced by the American astronomer Edward Hubble, who is the namesake for the Hubble Space Telescope. In the early 20th century, Hubble became one of the first astronomers to deduce that the universe was composed of multiple galaxies. His subsequent research led to his most renowned discovery that galaxies were moving away from each other at a speed in proportion to their distance. Hubble originally estimated the expansion rate to be 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec, with a megaparsec being equivalent to about 3.26 million light years. Hubble concluded that a galaxy 2 megaparsecs away from our galaxy was receding twice as fast as a galaxy only 1 megaparsec away. This estimate became known as the Hubble constant, which is proved for the first time that the universe was expanding. Astronomers have been recalibrating it with mixed results ever since. Let me drop for a sec. With the help of skyrocketing technologies, astronomers came up with measurements that differed significantly from Hubble's original calculations, slowing the expansion rate down to between 50 and 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And in the past decade, ultra-sophisticated instruments, such as the Planck satellite, have increased the precision of Hubble's original measurements in relatively dramatic fashion. In a paper entitled A New Measurement of the Hubble Constant and Matter Content of the Universe Using Extragalactic Background Light Gamma Ray Attenuation, the collaborative team compared the latest gamma ray attenuation data with the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope and Imaging Atmospheric Cherenkov Telescopes to devise their estimates from an extragalactic background light model. The novel strategy led to a measurement of approximately 67.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Gamma rays are the most energetic form of light. Extragalactic background light, is known as EBL, is a cosmic fog composed of all the ultraviolet, visible, and infrared light emitted by stars or from dust in their vicinity. When gamma rays and EBLs interact, they leave an observable imprint, a gradual loss of flow that scientists were able to analyze in formulating their hypothesis. The astronomical community is investing a large quantity of money and resources in doing precision cosmology with all the different parameters, including the Hubble constant, said Dieter Hartmann, a professor in physics and astronomy. Our understanding of these fundamental constants have defined the universe we now know of. When our understanding of laws becomes more precise, our definition of the universe also becomes more precise, which leads to new insights and discoveries. A common analogy of the expansion of the universe is a balloon dotted with spots, with each spot representing a galaxy. When the balloon is blown up, the spots spread out farther and farther. Let me drop for a sec. Some theorize that the balloon will expand to a particular point in time and then recollapse, said Desai, a graduate research assistant in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. But most people's common belief is that the universe will continue to expand until everything is so far apart there will be no observable light. At that point, the universe will suffer a cold death. But this is nothing for us to worry about. If it happens, it'll happen trillions of years from now. But if the balloon analogy is accurate, what is it exactly that's blowing up the balloon? Matter, the stars, the planets, even us. They're just a small fraction of the universe's overall composition, as Gillot explained. The large majority of the universe is made up of dark energy and dark matter, and we believe it is dark energy that is blowing up the balloon. Dark energy is pushing things away from each other. Gravity, which attracts objects towards each other, is the stronger force at the local level, which is why galaxies continue to collide with each other. But at cosmic distances, dark energy is the dominant force. It is remarkable that we are using gamma rays to study cosmology. Our technique allows us to use an independent strategy, a new methodology, independent of existing ones, to measure crucial properties of the universe, said Dominguez, who is also a former postdoctoral researcher in Agello's group. Our results show the maturity reached in the last decade by the relatively recent field of high-energy astrophysics. The analysis that we have developed paves the way for better measurements in the future using a Cherenkov telescope array, which is still in development and will be the most ambitious array of ground-based high-energy telescopes ever. Let me drop for a sec. Many of the same techniques used in the current paper correlate to previous work conducted by Agello and his counterparts. In an earlier project, which appeared in the journal Science, Agello and his team were able to measure all of the starlight ever emitted in the history of the universe. Quote, "What we know is that gamma ray photons from extragalactic sources travel in the universe towards Earth, where they can be absorbed by interacting with photons from starlight," Agello said. "The rate of interaction depends upon the length that they travel in the universe, and the length that they travel depends on expansion. If the expansion is low, they travel a small distance. If the expansion is large, they travel a very large distance. So the amount of absorption that we measure depends very strongly on the value of the Hubble constant. What we did was turn this around and use it to constrain the expansion rate of the universe itself." Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is KC2GS. Mm-hmm. Okay, for my last little story tonight, argon is the only noble gas that we have in any appreciable amount in our atmosphere. 0.93, according to those who should know. The strange thing about noble gases like helium, neon, and argon are that they are inert and don't react with other atoms. They are the loners of the periodic table. Well, apparently not when we look at the Earth's core. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory scientist, in collaboration with researchers at the University of Saskatchewan, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and the University of Chicago, have all discovered that at thermodynamic conditions mimicking that of the Earth's core, argon can react with nickel to form a stable argon-nickel compound. The research was published as a cover article in American Chemical Society, Earth Space Chemistry, and highlighted in Chemical Engineering News. Radioactive decay of potassium-40 present in the Earth's core is one of the main sources of heat that is believed to be crucial for powering Earth's geodynamo. That's a mechanism by which a celestial body such as the Earth generates a magnetic field. However, the fate of argon produced during the decay of potassium-40 is an open question. Noble gas elements, such as argon, are considered the most chemically inert elements on the periodic table, showing very little reactivity with other elements at temperatures and pressures found on Earth's surface. But in Earth's core, the reaction of metals with noble gas elements turns out to be quite different. Quote, although our recently published results highlighted that a noble gas element such as xenon can react with metals at elevated thermodynamic conditions, previous theoretical studies suggested that argon is quite reluctant to react with metals, even at pressures above those found in Earth's core, said one of the researchers. Let me drop for a second. To find out argon's fate, the team decided to challenge previous theoretical predictions and studied the possible reactivity of nickel with argon. When a nickel-argon mixture was subjected to pressures greater than 1.5 million times Earth's atmospheric surface pressure and temperatures above 2,000 degrees Kelvin, an X-ray diffraction measurement strongly indicated that a new compound was formed. Calculations revealed that at elevated temperatures, argon could indeed react with nickel. Experiments pointed to an alloy of 50% argon and 50% nickel, and the theoretical calculations perfectly matched a crystal structure of an intermetallic alloy, showing argon and nickel equally interspersed in a solid solution. The reactivity of argon opens up the possibility of argon's presence in Earth's core and may help solve outstanding geological questions about argon's location, one of the researchers said. Extreme pressures and temperatures lead to new chemistry rules. Moreover, our study highlights the need of close synergy between experimental and theoretical studies in this new frontier of chemical properties under extreme thermodynamic conditions. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is AC2GS. Okie doke. This is, once again, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and I hope that you enjoyed tonight's science talk. And hopefully, next week, I will have a whole bunch of very interesting news stories, and if I can figure one out, a new puzzler. So, once again, before I leave, if you have any technical mailbag-type questions for Dick and can't get on the technical net, if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to pass to Paul for the space report, or if you would like to ask me a question, suggest a topic, suggest a puzzler, or refute anything that I said, hopefully with references, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. Everything that I talk about will have links, and please check out the YouTube videos. I think you'll find them informative and entertaining. You'll find them at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, thanks to Dick and thanks to Paul for giving me the opportunity to do this every Sunday night. And I hope some of you enjoyed it. And I will pass it back to Dick so that he can pass it over to Paul for the space report.
Very fine, Roy. Roy, you gave us a number of candidates, but please repeat. What, in your opinion, was the most expensive substance?
I think $2.7 quadrillion a gram would speak of antiprotons being the most expensive material in this world, at least.
Okay, theoretically expensive, even though I don't think anybody could easily deliver antiprotons to you in a reasonable container. You could say I want to buy a gram of them, but I don't think that anybody can supply a gram, even a nanogram or a picogram. But how would they supply them to them to say that you now possess them? There's a problem.
That's time complete.
Nothing of these super expensive substances can be conveniently be delivered. Back to you for any final comments on that one, Roy. I don't think anybody could really deliver that to you today. Over to you, Roy. K2RIW.
Would agree with you. But if you are at CERN, right next to the Hadron Collider, and you have an experiment that you can put into the same room that needs to, say, rent a proton or two, they're doing that. They're doing all kinds of interesting experiments trying to build anti-hydrogens and such. So you need to get the supply somewhere. I gave it in per grams because the other things come in grams, and so that's the best way to compare. With antiprotons, you're probably paying per atomic mass unit. Each atomic mass unit is the weight of a proton, and because antiparticles have the same mass, it's the mass of an antiproton. So I don't know exactly how much a single atomic mass unit of antiproton costs when you scale it down from a gram, but it's relatively cheaper. But again, like many things, they don't last forever. The francium that I mentioned, which is rather expensive, nearly as expensive, has a half-life of 20 minutes. So by the next day, it's gone.
Good answer. Okay. Paul, WS2N, what's going on in space? You got it, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. I got a new material, the one that Roy just spoke about, the mixture of argon and nickel mixed together. It sounds like that would be one of these multi-trillion-dollar items. What do you think, Roy?
Probably not that expensive because they made it in a at least for a small amount of time. The problem is the conditions to keep it in existence are really expensive. So you have to keep it at incredibly high temperatures, incredibly high pressures. If you're able to do that, you could make gallons of the stuff, I guess.
Okay, amazing. I use argon as a cover gas for heliox welding, and there's no way in the world that mixed with any of the stainless steel that I was putting together. But might get some porosity if I made a mistake, but it sure wasn't caused from argon. Wow. Okay, and I don't know if you're keeping count of all these different weeks that are going by, but I have you at the 100th week, so congratulations on that. I know it could be one way or the other, but that's what we're up to, Roy. AC2GSWS.
Great, thanks, thanks, Paul. I for some odd reason I don't keep count. I just keep plowing along. So I hit 100. That's very nice to know. Thank you.
Okay, very good. But all I do is I just keep count. You know, in other words, I title everything, and then I save all the nets to the cloud, and so each time it goes by, each one clicks up one. So, that way. If I don't do that, I'll get a little fouled up. Because it creates like your own Google type of deal. You could go back and, you know, you put it into search and you know, for whatever you're going to put in, and it'll come up, you know, whatever net it might be. And then you could review it. So, okay, we have a few topics tonight. Let me drop it just to see if anybody has any space questions or that they want to be answered before we start this. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report. I know we had a lot of nice topics dealing with astronomy and